You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Right Stream and hashtag Right Stream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Welcome to the Speculative Fiction Cantina with your host, S. Evan Townsend.
And hello, and welcome to a special day after Christmas Boxing Day edition of the Speculative Fiction Cantina, your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, and things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. I am your host. I am S. Evan Townsend. I have 5 published science fiction and fantasy novels, and if you want to learn more about me, go to my website, you okay, Clyde? At www.sevantownsend.com. Today on the Speculative Fiction Cantina, I'm very pleased to welcome writers Nancy M.C. Young and Clyde P. Riddlesbrood. If you'd like to speak with either of our guests or ask a question, please call 347-945-7246. That's 347-94. That number's wrong. 945. I'm very
7246.
347-945-7246. Yes. I got mixed up. And you need to press 1, and that'll put you in the queue to going on the air. Okay, it must be the day after Christmas because I am barely able to do this. Anyway, if you'd like more information about my guests, it's on my blog. There's links to their books. There's links to their websites. And that's at blog.s7townsend.com. And at blog.s7townsend.com, you can get there through my website, which is www.s7townsend.com. Or Google me, S7 Townsend, and my website should be the first thing that comes up. So we'll get going. And Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Evan. This is pretty exciting. Day after Christmas, it's pretty quiet out, and it's really nice to be on air speaking to whoever's listening out there.
Great. Thank you. You have a book out called Strum. Can you tell us about that book?
Yeah, well, you know, Strum was published last year through Inkwater Press in Portland, Oregon, but I'm in Los Angeles. This book has been, you know, it's my first novel, and it's a wonderful tale about family and about spirits and about love. And, you know, it travels across a couple centuries, about 150 years, and across 4 continents. It's a pretty global tale. There's a bit of magical realism to really, you know, make it interesting, I think. But it's really the story that I think transcends time and generations. And it's all the things that I would want to read about. You know, I tell people this is the book that I wanted to read. I have a background in international affairs, so I've traveled a lot to about 30 countries. You know, I was an English major as well, so literary fiction was kind of my genre. I really, really enjoyed this trip that I've been on ever since I published it. It's won about 6 awards, which surprised
wow.
me. And, so I'm here just kind of talking about it and hoping that people might pick it up and enjoy it, too.
So it's won 6 awards. Any of the awards that you're especially proud of?
Well, all of them, you know, equally, because I really didn't expect any of them. About this time last year, I submitted to a couple of national and international awards. The one that I guess was probably the biggest is the IPPI Awards, the Independent Publishers Book Awards. I won a silver medal and best regional fiction for Canada East. You know, the story starts out in Canada, and it goes kind of global. You know, it goes to Europe, it goes through Asia, but it starts out in Canada, and the main characters reside there. So I submitted to that category, and it won silver medal in Canada East. So that was pretty exciting. That was in May. And earlier in the year, it won I guess, honorable mention at the Hollywood Book Festival, the New York Book Festival, and the San Francisco Book Festival, and the Great Northwest Book Festivals. These are kind of place-based book festivals that selected the book to be, up there award-winning, and I was pretty surprised that I went to all the cities and accepted my award and met a lot of wonderful authors, too, all independent published authors. And then just last month, I won the final one of the year. It was the USA Best Book Awards. I won a finalist in literary fiction. And that is a national award, too, that celebrates not only self-published but mainstream published books as well. So that was a big surprise, but, just an opportunity to, get it out there and show people that, even self-published books can compete with some of the big publishers. And as you probably know, the industry is changing now, so it's an opportunity for people really that have a story in them to get it to print no matter what. Don't wait for the publishers to come to you or for an agent to come to you. Just get it out there and see what happens. And that's what I did, and I was pleasantly surprised that it was selected in all of these categories and award programs. So I feel very blessed this time of year in particular.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Clyde, welcome to the show.
Hey, hello there, sir.
How are you doing today?
Very, very good. Very, very good. I appreciate the opportunity to be here speaking with you today. And, my situation is a little bit different. My book's not complete yet, although it's in what's called deep editing, for those of you that are in that or aware of those kind of processes. But it's basically complete. It's been through several rewrites, and now I'm going through one more level of deep editing before I try to start sending it to publishers. So it's still in the, later phases, but still not done yet. And I'm not like a professional writer by any stretch of the imagination. I'm actually a theater producer. We have a theater company in New Jersey, and we do shows, theatrical shows since 2000, all around New Jersey, Pennsylvania, New York, Delaware, and we're very, very successful. Actually, we do about 150 shows a year, including some very large scale productions, and also a kids acting camp that we do in the summer, and also during the spring and fall. So it's actually a pretty successful enterprise. But a few years ago, I decided, it kind of started off in a funny way how this book became something that I was working on. But I took over the endeavor. I started writing it, and then one thing led to another, and I just kept working on it. I just found myself kind of like really not able to stop writing it, and that's pretty much how it became a novel. So I guess maybe my situation is a little different than some. I didn't really seek to write a novel. It just kind of organically developed that way.
My book actually started as a screenplay. I just finished film school, and I had this picture in my head of the story that just kept, and then it wrote itself. So I understand what you mean by that.
Yeah.
The book just writing kind of writes itself. The characters take over and tell you what to write. And before you know it, I had like 300... I had about 400 pages. I had to edit it down to about 380.
A lot of people find that they have a book inside them, and it just it demands to come out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I actually had a longer text, and I remember kind of pitching it to a couple agents, and one guy was a film guy. He goes, "You know what? I don't read anything that's more than 80,000 words, so forget it." So I thought, okay, I think I better cut it back. So I actually brought it down. But, I said at that point, I said, it doesn't matter. This is the book I want to publish, and I'm not going to cut it back any further because it's not ready for a film yet until I had its time as a book. And then if somebody really loves it, they'll adapt it for screen, and it's a totally different process.
Yes, it is. So, Clyde, you said that you write gothic horror self-help. That caught my attention. What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess I've always been, ever since I started the theater company, I've, you know, I've always personally been very interested in kind of like the pick yourself up by the bootstraps kind of independent, rugged individualist kind of concept. And when I started my business, I was only like in my later 20s. And of course, anybody that's a small business owner will tell you that, you know, being an entrepreneur is, you know, the deck is stacked against you. You know, you have a lot of obstacles. You have a lot of, it's hard to do it. It's not as easy as just, you know, working at a regular job. And I've been able to do that in an industry that is very, very challenging. So, you know, what happened to me is, I would say back as early as like 2008, you know, people started to, I remember like I would call customers and every once in a while I realized that our theater company had got big enough where I was starting to get calls from people that had written scripts. And I had somehow made it onto the mailing list of these people who cold call or get people to try to produce their plays. So to me, that was kind of an interesting moment in time where I was forced to say to myself, hey, I must have reached something here because obviously now I'm the target of people to try to have people produce their plays. That was, you know, my own personal moment in time where I felt like, hey, you know, we're finally really, you know, we're not just a little organization anymore. You know, we're doing some pretty large productions at some pretty big houses and making a living at it. This is my only job for many years. But to get back to your point about the self-help, it's just that I kind of felt like the whole book started actually in a weird way. It started because we had a publicity person. And they said, hey, you know, you should really try to fill out this mascot character. And this mascot character is Clyde P. Riddlesbrood for the theater company. And they said, well, you should really have some kind of a, you know, some kind of backstory for this mascot. So I said, all right. So I started to create this backstory. And he was supposed to be a magical kind of character and a little spooky, a little bit like Beetlejuice. So we started to flush this out, and as I started to flush it out, I realized that, you know, it was impossible to try to make a short thing about this. I needed to start, it started to grow and grow and grow. But I guess what I mean by the self-help part is it's a spooky ghost story in a lot of ways. However, the message is very simple, and the idea is, you know, never let go of your dreams. So I kind of took that motif, that hero's journey motif, and applied it to this story. So, which I suppose is not completely new, but the message is a little bit stronger in this story than I've ever read before, where it's a kind of a spooky story, a horror story in many ways, but it has this almost like a self-help message to it. You know, I'm not sure if that's enough explanation for you, but that's what I got so far.
I love that Beetlejuice reference. It sounds really intriguing. Actually, my story...
Go ahead.
I'll just jump in here. My story is kind of similar with actually like spirits of ancestors coming back to help, you know, family members several generations on that actually are suffering in different ways. You know, I put in a lot of history and, you know, it goes through several wars. It goes through, you know, hardships of individual characters. And the, like the spirits of the ancestors, in fact, the story is about a pair of lovers that live on through these two guitars that are made by their great-great-grandson. And he doesn't know it. He's actually deaf. But he doesn't know it, but his great-great-grandparents kind of give him the gift of music because he can't hear. And they guide him, you know, into the forest to the place where they had met 100 years ago. And you know, he makes the guitars from the tree. But the motif throughout the book is very much about, you know, everything we get from our personality to, you know, our gifts and our talents are from the people that came before you. So it's all your ancestral people. But they can live on in the everyday. We don't feel or see it, or we don't think about it, but they're there because they're always going to be in you. But the sort of metaphorical symbolism that I use in the story is through the guitars, because I was thinking, like, how do you get a story out of? In fact, these guitars are made out of these 800-year-old trees fell in the forest, like, you know, where the great grandparents lived, and their spirits live in the tree that he makes these guitars. And, you know, when I was thinking about the story, I was thinking, well, how do you release a spirit from a piece of wood? And I thought, well, music, right? My kind of spiritual, metaphysical kind of occurrence. And if you suspend your, you know, rational belief, you can, and you believe, like many people do, whether it's religious or just spiritual, you know, there's comfort, like self-help in some ways, to believe. And so that's what my story is about too.
Yeah, I mean, there's some
from.
Parallels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't expect it, but there you go.
Yeah, I book these shows, I don't try to come up with a theme or anything. So yeah, it's real interesting that you both have sort of similar motifs in your novels or your work in progress.
Well, you know, the funny thing
is
I mean. Well, I'm sorry, not to interrupt, but I've read quite a few, you know, books by, you know, like the Chicken Soup for the Soul and all that kind of stuff like that. And one of the things that I personally was never crazy about, I like the ideas in a lot of the ways that, you know, mind over matter concept. Like if you believe something strongly enough, mm-hmm. you know, in some ways it seems as if the universe or the world will bend to your will to some degree.
Right.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
I've found that in my life where I found that, you know, when I really want something, I just see things magically just seem to start going in that direction. Now, whether I'm just fooling myself or whether there's something I don't understand.
Well, you've heard of The Secret, right?
Right.
Self-fulfilling.
And I've
seen
that.
What do you call it? Attraction. The laws of attraction, right?
Right.
Now,
the thing
is
well, you know, I do kind of buy into some of that, but the problem that I've had with it is that it seems to be, and this, I don't want to sound offensive here, but it seems to always be presented in a very feminine, soft way. And, you know, in my experience, the world is a challenging obstacle, you know, gauntlet-like place, you know. It's like a clay that doesn't want to be shaped, and it requires force and will and aggression, you know. It just seems like I wanted to tell that same kind of concept, but through a more masculine, maybe even at times more scary, more violent way, but in a way that might appeal to people that aren't really going to get all excited about healing crystals and, you know, Indian poses and chants and stuff. I mean, I think people get a lot of Western people get turned off by that. You know, people that are more maybe with a mind more like my own. So I'm attracted to the ideas, yet the packaging of the ideas, I think, is a turn off to many, and is a turn off to me. So I figured, you know, I want to incorporate a self-help message and an idea that, you know, you can really achieve whatever you want to achieve so long as you're willing to believe it. But, you know, it's not just going to be laying down meditating. It's going to be war, you know, and prepare yourself for it. So I guess it's a little different approach.
Well, it's interesting because my book, you know, I have a male character as the main character, and he goes through hell, you know, to get where he needs to go. So I hear you. I think it's true that a lot of men in particular are turned off by the soft, you know, metaphysical kind of, meditate and everything will be fine. But I think, you know, not that I'm a proponent of The Secret necessarily, but, you know, I read it and I found it fascinating because this laws of attraction is so true. Like you said, in my life, it's been exactly the same, even with this book. You know, like, it took 5 years to get it done. And, you know, I kept visualizing it. It just kept coming to me, like, you have to do this, you have to do this. And I never thought it would have any, you know, like, any audience at all. And it won all these awards. So it's obviously struck a nerve. But you're right, you know, part of the I thought about publishing it under a different name, you know, because just being female, I mean, often men don't read books by women because they assume it's going to be feminine and soft and, you know, they're just not interested. It doesn't appeal to them. But
right.
I found that men actually love this book more than women, and I was so surprised. But then I realized it's because my character is male, and he goes through hell. You know, he I mean, I've done a lot of hiking, backpacking, you know, really rough terrain. I've been up to Mount Everest. But men don't expect women to have that perspective, and that's
right.
men's problem, not women. I mean, women don't have any problem with that. They'll read whatever. But men have that. So, in fact, I present myself as Nancy M.C. Young. I thought about publishing as N.M.C. Young so that somebody wouldn't know that I was a woman. But, you know, these themes are universal, and they, you know, it doesn't matter if you're male or female. We all have a hard life. Women do, too. We have also struggles that men don't realize. I mean, every day is a struggle. But because we're feminine, we tend to kind of soften it, and it's easier to be accepted as a woman to be softer. But I mean,
I hear exactly what you're saying. I think I was reacting more to, I would say, the general branding approach that even The Secret. I mean, you know, if you just look at the book and the colors they choose and the images they choose. Now, they kind of have a little bit more of like a Da Vinci Code kind of look a little bit.
Yeah,
too.
It's black and red. So
it's not,
to
it's
me,
not,
it's not feminine
overly,
at all.
But a lot of them, like a lot of the books, you know, I'll look at, you know, they have like just this like picture of a lady with like a halo coming out and, you know, somebody, you know, and, you know, a lot of that imagery, I think, is, you know, now whether it be true or not is something completely different. I'm not arguing it could be the most true thing in the world. But the reality is the packaging to some degree makes people think it's, you know, silly or something kind of, you know, new agey or something. So I guess, but I believe the message is important because for me it has really transformed my life. Like, I mean, when I was younger, I was very analytical, you know. I mean, I watched, you know, Star Trek and stuff like that, but, you know, I really didn't believe in ghosts. I didn't really care. I wasn't very religious. But as I got older, the very analytical aspect of me began to start to question the things that I was seeing. I was beginning to say, wait a minute, you know, this is just, you know, it can't just be serendipity that these things just happen. You know, it's like, how did that, it's just not luck. Luck isn't a good enough, isn't a scientific enough explanation to begin to account for this. So I started to begin to explore a metaphysical aspect that I kind of ignored or even thought was stupid when I was younger. So, and once I had accepted it, it changed a lot of things, even in my business life. So, you know, I wanted to try to pass that on, you know, to maybe other people, but maybe they'd be more willing to read it in a form like this. Maybe they'd read something like this and then say, oh, this is kind of cool looking. And then they read it and get the very same thing, just in a different color pill.
Hmm. Yeah, I did the same thing. You know, mine is like very literary, but it has a very Eastern message. But, you know, it's really interesting because my story starts in Canada and goes through Europe. It goes through Asia. You know, it's like it circles the globe. And I've had people from both Eastern and Western say, oh, my God, finally, you know, a book that transcends both East and West without pandering to either one. I mean, I get really annoyed when I read things that are like, you know, mysticism and Eastern is supposed to be all whatever. And I think, wow, you're going to turn off half of the population because they just don't find it interesting or whatever. So I wrote this kind of book that just transcends all genres and all
right.
all nationalities and everything. And it is actually striking a chord. I'm pretty surprised. But I knew from the beginning, like you're saying, Clyde, you know, having grown up in a very Western mode, you know, being logical and everything, you just yeah, what's the word? I mean, you just kind of like throw out all the mystical stuff as being hocus pocus. I'm the opposite. I grew up, you know, in an Asian background, and so I had all this stuff, but I threw it out too because I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. We're in America, you know, why would I believe in all this stuff, ghosts and everything that my parents tried to show me? And I rejected it for so long, and finally, now that I'm grown up and have kids of my own, I go, you know, oh my God, that is really the answer. And it's like you have to let go of all this logical stuff that actually binds you to kind of this one way of thinking and be open. I mean, I'm not a hocus-pocus kind of person, but just being open to everything is really the answer. And then suddenly the universe opens up, and it's like, oh, my God, everything you want is possible. You just need to not restrain yourself. Like, let it go. Let all the disbelief go, because what could happen? What could happen if you actually believed in the supernatural or believed in spirits or believed in you know, the positive wavelengths or whatever. It's maybe new agey, but don't think of it that way.
Well,
and
I think it's only new agey when you start using terms that people. So, I mean, the thing is, packaging is so overpoweringly
powerful.
Important. And mm-hmm. I mean, just to say something like, you know, that's what I'm saying. I think the ideas are sound. And me, mm-hmm. I just admit that I do not claim to understand the mechanisms by which the universe accomplishes these things, but mm-hmm. I know certain things, and you know, when you really desire something and focus all your energy on it and really imagine it and visualize it and all that kind of, mm-hmm. I really do feel like the world bends to give you what you want, and I've mm-hmm. seen that, and it's worked for me in miraculous
mm-hmm.
ways,
mm-hmm.
But if I sit there and say, you know, oh, you know, my brain is putting out these vibes, man, and it's going, I mean, immediately I'm going to lose everybody because it's just so stupid sounding. And it's not fair, but semantics are important. You know, if you start, just like if you start describing the same thing in religious terms of angels and
mm-hmm,
prayer,
yeah.
you're going to turn off a lot of that population. If you talk about vibrations and crystals and weird crap, you're going to turn off anybody that's not interested in that. So the challenge is really to repackage the concept in a way that is digestible, that will be accepted, or at least suspension of disbelief. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
everybody believes in ghost stories. I mean, everybody loves ghost stories. They might not believe necessarily in ghosts, but everybody's mind has played tricks on them. Everybody, you know, ghost stories have been told since the beginning of ancient times, you know. So, I mean, it certainly transcends religion, transcends culture. You know, there's got to be some reason why humans love ghost stories so much. There's got to be something there.
Well, there's got to be an explanation for where we go after, you know. Like,
yeah.
you think about it, you know, do you really just disappear? Because it's all about energy fields, right? I mean, if you want to look at it from a scientific standpoint, we exist and our thought patterns are captured in wavelengths. I mean, they have proof of that. So who's to say once you die, like, you know, if that really does end, or can it continue in some kind of manner or form? And I say with DNA, we carry it with us. You know, the past is in the present. And then we may be very well in the future, too. If you look at, you know, Einstein's relativity theories and all that, it's like, yeah, I mean, who's to say that time is linear? You know, who's to say that just because we only perceive it that way, that it can only be that way?
Well, I mean, like anything, there could be just some other type of energy we're just not aware of yet.
Sure,
I mean, we didn't know about electricity
universes.
For a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know about magnetism.
Yeah.
They all exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now
mm-hmm.
we admit them. We can't
mm-hmm.
see radiation. You know, we can't see mm-hmm. electrons flowing through a wire, but we know it's real.
Right.
To me, it's not such a stretch of the imagination to believe that there's mm-hmm. more aspects of reality that we just simply don't have the technology to see. But, you know, the funny thing about me, and my story is a lot about this, too, because of acting. Like, the
right.
whole thing takes place within the context of a theater troupe. So I have a unique experience that I know a lot of other performers have had, and that's that when you're performing in front of audiences, especially a lot, like, I've done probably close to 5,000 shows, you know what I mean? And a lot of it is improv, and a lot of it is comedy. And probably actually out there, everybody out there in your listening audience will know that, you know, you walk into a stadium and you feel everybody cheer. It actually feels like it moves you in a way that you're not used to being moved. You know, it feels like, whoa, I can almost feel the joy of this 1,000 people crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't know what it is, but they feel that. Well, when you're an actor, you're really in tune with those people. And veteran, you know, performers will tell you that, you know, when we're out there on stage, even if you're not looking at the audience, you can almost feel like you're tasting the energy flowing up on that stage from them. And you can change your words, change the exact way you say a word just slightly because you think it'll, you know, it'll make that rock bounce a few more times on that water, you know? So it's just like really, it's amazing. But as a performer, you really feel like you're swimming in that energy more than I think average people do.
Absolutely, yeah. Musicians in particular as well. You know, my book is about artists and musicians. And I mean, I worked in the arts many years too, did a bit of theater. But music in particular too has a certain, you know, vibration and resonance that people can feel so strongly.
Right.
So, yeah, that's exactly right. And the arts are where you can open up to other realms of, you know, existence or whatever and really transport yourself. And people who don't have that, is, I always feel sorry for them, you know, they never experience that.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're just not used to experiencing it. Mm-hmm. I kind of liken, I guess, an artist in that, to me, it seems to boil down to the simple idea that you're performing in front of a large group of individuals and their focus mm-hmm. is entirely on you, you know, and I think that there's something to that. You know, and if you're a musician, you know, you could be in front of 1,000 people or 500 people that are just sitting there looking and staring and focusing on just you. You know, and if you think about it, there's something interesting about that. It's like a kind of a liminal space. It's like somewhere in between reality and non-reality. And, I mean, if you think about it, everything boils down to that. I mean, what is a church? A church is one person in the front or a few people talking and a lot of people listening. You know, and except they go a little further. They want you to close your eyes and pray, you know. So, I mean, you know, even great political leaders, you know, I mean, even people like a Hitler. I mean, look at one person in front of millions of people can do. And I think there's something to that, that we don't – it's not just persuasiveness or, you know, good rhetoric or oratory skills. I think there is something there when you can get – as many minds as possible to focus on you. And I think there's something there that we don't quite understand yet.
Well, absolutely. It's that again, the law of attraction says the same thing. If everybody's wishing for the same thing, it definitely will happen because it's energy fields, you know, working at the same, you know, whatever resonance or whatever to make the universe again bend to your will. And I think it's true. I mean, we're on this earth as humans, and we have thought for a reason. You know, we make what it is, that reality. It's interesting. I read somewhere once that they said about, I mean, talk about religion, that, you know, you have to have the genetic makeup to believe, and that some people don't have that gene, and so they can never believe. They never will be able to suspend, you know, logical belief to believe in God. And then those who have a very strong amount of whatever that genetic makeup is, they are the really, truly religious people, and, you know, to an extent that they may even see themselves as prophets or whatever, become a preacher or whatever. So there's a scientific, you know, explanation for all that as well. But you're right, there are certain people who feel that they can persuade people because they have that ability to, you know, transcend all belief. Like, I mean, even Hitler is a terrible thing to say, but he was so powerful. Like, he was able to articulate what people wanted to hear, as terrible as the things he was saying, but he was able to touch a nerve. So every leader in the world, you know, from time immemorial has had that ability. And so as writers, I mean, we have that ability too to be able to, you know, if you're a good writer, to be able to articulate what people want to hear or need to hear.
Right.
And, you know, I always think that's an obligation, you know, and somebody was asking me about the awards and, you know, what my New Year's resolution was. And I said, well, you know, once you win an award, someone has endorsed you to keep writing, you know. So I said, that's my New Year's resolution, is to kind of teach and show people, you know, what they need to hear. I think it was Hemingway once said, you know, a good book is truer than, you know, what is it? Yeah, the mark of, no, like I said, a good book has, all good books have one thing in common. It's that they are truer than if they actually happened.
Right.
And it's like, that is the role of the writer, is to show the truth in what you write to whoever reads it. You know, it didn't matter if it didn't happen. It, you know, in fact, it's better that it didn't happen. It's just if you're able to show the reader something new or teach them something or whatever. But the truth in your writing is so important that you show, like you're saying, you know, that the universe has all these wonderful things that can happen if you truly believe. So that's your obligation now, is to, like, write it as
best. And the dangers are the opposite. And the dangers are also the opposite. Is that, you know, what I have found is the self-destructive impulse. You know, you got to realize that the power has two sides. Mm-hmm. You know, and most people are only, unfortunately, acquainted with the one side. And that is particular. Some of what happens in this story that I've written here is the hero character. You know, he has to struggle with the fact that he has such bad luck and bad things are always happening, and, and he doesn't realize that he's basically his own worst enemy. He wants. It's kind of like that idea that the law of attraction, except that really focusing on the negative side effects, and it takes him a long time to realize that he's powerful, but he's making these bad things happen to him because he creates his own demons. Like have you ever seen it? There was an old movie called Forbidden Planet. You ever hear see that? It was a one where Leslie Nielsen was actually in, and it's a great movie. They go on this planet, and they were super advanced, and they figured out how to like use telepathy and stuff. And what happens? They kill themselves within a very short period of time, and they couldn't figure out what happened to this civilization. But what happened is they became so powerful that they could no longer control what they called the id. Which was there's a part of the mind that wants to kill yourself, almost wants to destroy things. You know, it's like
it's the reptile brain.
Yeah, it's like actually, it's that part of you that says you can't do it, you can't do it, or the part of you that says it's not going to work.
It's a fight or flight instinct, right?
Right.
I mean, and it's based out of fear. And even the laws of attraction talks about that. It's like you've got to transcend that because you actually have an ego, and the ego is your human side. The id is your base animal instinct that is a survival instinct. But we're bigger than we're better than that. We can go beyond it and actually rationalize things and do good. The other part is the fear. It's not bad necessarily, but it's fear-based. It's about eat or, you know, be eaten kind of thing when we were dinosaurs or, you know, cavemen. But now we can transcend that and try to open up to a greater, you know, universal whatever that is that makes us human and makes us do good and not live in fear. So, you know, have you read Eckhart Tolle's book? He wrote The Power of Now, and then now he's got the New Earth or something like that.
You know what? I haven't heard of that.
You've got to read that. It's amazing. He talks about how, you know, every person has the two brains, right? You've got your id, which is your reptile brain, and then you have your ego. He says, unfortunately, people are so ego-based that, I mean, they have transcended the id part to become ego-based. And ego-based is good in some ways in that, you know, it gives you freedom to become, you know, more than just living out of fear like an animal. But you can also focus too much on your ego so that you feel like everything is like, about you.
Right.
And so he's like, no, let go of that, too, because even the bad stuff, the paranoia and the depression or whatever you feel is based on your ego, and that you're so stuck there that, you know, you become trapped in your own, you know, unhappiness. And he's like, if you can let go of that and just live for the moment, like don't worry about the past because it's already gone. You can't do anything about it. And don't worry about the future because you don't know what it's going to be. So just focus on the now. And if you can focus on the now, just appreciate what you have and where you are and all the people around you. And, I mean, he's a best-selling author as well now, and he's got this whole, you know, following. But it's interesting because, you know, like, it's a mixed bag, right? Like, if you're too ego-based, you're egomaniac. There's that word. And then if you're not egotistical enough, you become this, you know, like, worthless or not, you know, like,
or just become somebody's follower, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like finding the right balance. And actually, Tolle's work is really fascinating. You should read it. I think you'd appreciate it too. And he's talking about the new earth. The new earth is that if we all can reach that point where we're not always obsessed with the past or the future, and that we can live in the moment of now, we'd be in a happier place, and we can manifest what we want. You know, we can attract what we need, and you know, if we're not fear-based and we're not so ego-based, that we're just living in this universal kind of wonderfulness. I mean, it sounds, I'm not doing it justice, but you know, that's the basic premise there. And I mean, like you say with packaging, like I got a little tired of that too. It's like, oh, okay, you know, there's only so much of Eckhart Tolle I can read too, because it's like, okay,
well,
you can only be in the now for so long, and then you kind of.
Well, you know, even the way you've explained it, that one of the biggest things that if you follow a thought out to its extreme place, you realize that, you know, let's just say if the law of attraction is true, right? Well, you know, the law of attraction is personal. It's individual. It's not collective, right?
Right.
So, you know, so what that means is that there are individuals that are superior at using this ability and individuals that are less than superior or inferior. Well, since everybody's competing simultaneously and continually, it's a competition. So the problem with the idea of these thoughts leading to some kind of utopian thing or some kind of peace, it seems silly to me, because when you start to look at it and it's if you follow that logic all the way, what it would mean is that, you know, you're going to have, you know, extreme inequality, because, you know, other people, you know, you're eventually not just fighting the universe. What you're doing is you're fighting others like yourselves or groups like yourselves that are trying to manifest their things. And if their things are in conflict with other people's things and they have an issue, then it's a question of how many people are praying on your side, how many people, you know, if that's the mechanism, then all I'm saying is, based on the rules that they're saying, I don't see how that would lead to peace. I would think that would just be like any other technology for acquiring gain, you know. So that's where I have a hard time visualizing how all this stuff is so peaceful that way. You know, I don't know if the end game.
You're kind of half empty or half full debate, you know. But to me, I think I subscribe to more that you're reaching towards a better place. I mean, I don't know if you know anything about Buddhism, but, you know, the whole concept of reincarnation and that each life you get better and better. Like, you know, some people do actually go backwards and, you know, they come back as dogs or whatever because they didn't do, you know, whatever. But I do believe, I'm an optimistic person. Again, you know, it's half full or half empty. And Eckhart Tolle, I think, is also saying that universal good is what most of us want, and that it's when you're ego-focused that you want for yourself only. And then if you can let go of that, you yourself will actually be happier, because you're not wanting and you're not desiring all the time. You're just living and you're appreciating what you have and where you are. And, you know, life is pretty darn good.
But that's a rarity in human history. I mean, the more people acquire power, the more wild they get. Yeah.
This is fascinating. I could let you guys go on forever, but we got to take a break. And we got to get to the ratings, and we got to do a bunch of other stuff. And you guys are really interesting to listen to, and this is amazing. I've never had two authors talk like this before.
Wow. How did you get us together at the same time?
That's great.
I don't know. This is great. This is serendipitous. But we got some other stuff to do, so we'll be back with our guests, Nancy M.C. Young and Clyde P. Riddlesbrood, in a few moments.
You're listening to the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.
Hi, I'm Diane.
And this is Denise.
And we want to invite you to listen to the History Goes Bump podcast.
Ghost tours for the theater of the mind.
The History Goes Bump podcast. A show featuring a look at historic locations, people, and events. With a twist, this history podcast is haunted. So grab your slippers, hot chocolate, flashlight, and maybe even that baseball bat, and join us.
You can find the show at iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other various podcast catchers.
Check out the website at historygoesbump.com.
Keep it spooky.
This is the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.
And welcome back. After all the metaphysical discussion we had throughout the show, now we're going to talk about something scientific. Excuse me. This is from space.com, and the full story is on my blog, and my blog is, of course, blog.s7townsend.com. In a recent experiment, the quantum state, i.e. the direction it was spinning of a light particle, instantly traveled 15.5 miles across the fiber optic cable. Now, this is the farthest that scientists have ever successfully sent a quantum teleportation. And now advances in quantum teleportation could lead to better internet, because right now things on the internet travel at the speed of light, which is a finite speed. But quantum teleportation, they happen instantly. And you might not think that's a big difference, but there is actually a time delay between when you're watching a satellite program that comes from a satellite. The satellites are so far away that there's like a 2-second delay in the light speed by the time it gets to you. So it's not live. It's actually delayed by a few seconds. This doesn't mean we'll be beaming up Scotty very soon. No one has teleported matter because of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but this is teleporting information instantly, and so it's not bound by the speed of light. Now, thanks to this work, it's something called quantum entanglement, where you got two particles like photons, and they are entangled to each other, and they stay connected no matter how far apart they are, and they can transmit data between them instantaneously. Now, this could lead to quantum computers, and a quantum computer can make your desktop look like today's supercomputers. And supercomputers would be, well, maybe this is what's going to lead us to artificial intelligence and super robots and all sorts of interesting things coming up in the future. So we are back with our guests, Nancy M.C. Young and Clyde P. Riddles-Brood. And Clyde, do you have a reading for us?
Yes, I do. I do. It's part of my book here. I don't know if you want me to set the stage a little bit first or just dive right into it. Is there a special process by which
it's
you
up
do
to
that?
You. If you think the stage needs to be set, take a few moments and set the stage, or just dive right in. It's up to you.
Okay. Well, the whole story is about this character in a nutshell that loses everything, and they're back to scratch, and they have to go back and stay in their mother's attic, where they stayed as a child. So this part of the story is kind of like, being forced to go into a pretty gloomy situation. So I'll start with that right there. And, let me know if I'm going too long for us. Okay. When I arrived, I walked up to the door, imagining a warm, loving return and a sympathetic audience to speak of my worries. But I knew that would not happen, for my mother had remarried years ago a man named Nelson, but a month had passed since he had collapsed suddenly in the living room and died there. Understandably, my mother's mood was quite similar to mustard gas, a noxious vapor always seeking the lowest point. I would have resumed sleeping in the car if I could, but cold and the lack of gas money compelled me to take my old shadow-haunted cell on the third floor where I had stayed as a boy. I began the tedious process of carrying my belongings upstairs, past the comfortable and familiar floors and into the attic. As I opened the door leading to the topmost story, a cool blast of air greeted me. I turned on the old light switch with a free finger, activating the single light bulb hanging from the ceiling. Walking up the narrow case, I noticed that many of the steps were still broken, voids between the boards my feet had remembered to shun since my childhood. The weight of the heavy box I carried began to tire my arms, and my shoes repeatedly snagged the steps as I climbed, catching on countless small staples in the wood from a long-gone carpet. Once up the last flight, I dropped my bag at the threshold and looked around. The attic was comprised of three rooms, the walls painted a dull gray with occasional holes in children's graffiti throughout. The main room was dark with a single low-watt bulb to see by directly over the bed. On the other side of the room, barely visible, sat a table covered with books, papers, and shadows. Clearly no attention had been paid there for some time, and even the air tasted stale and uncirculated. I pulled open one of the windows to an icy gust and soon regretted it. Cool, cold, poorly plastered, and seldom walked, the space had never felt the hot waters of the furnace below. The anemic flow of the pipes barely warmed the feet of the radiators in this lonely tower. Fatigued, I wandered over and slouched into an old brown recliner. My mind was a churning suspension of muck swirling in my skull. I thought to sit would surely settle me, but as the weight shifted from my feet to my rear, I realized I'd been unkindly deceived. Rather than relaxing comfortably, I began to sink further and further into the chair, its weak and broken springs giving little support. I slowly descended into the bulgy seat, a process taking several awkward moments until finally I had reached rock bottom. I wiped my runny nose upon my sleeve and thought to myself, now this is a place to write a comedy. Benumbed and begrudgingly, I gathered myself and emptied my bags onto old furniture consigned to the room since I was 12 or maybe younger. I opened the old black box of mine, a makeup kit that I had used since my first shows. Reaching inside, I pulled out a photo or two and began to look at them, reminiscing over images of a life now over. It slowly occurred to me that this moment felt very familiar, as if this experience had happened once before and it was true. I walked over to the old table for a closer look, and from its surface picked up a small painted figurine. I turned it over in my hands a few times and studied it as best as I could in the dim light. Its features were well-worn, robed, and its face bearded. The floppy brim of its enchanter's hat folded secretly over one eye, and its painting only was half-finished, allowing much of the pewter to show through. Years earlier, another world had ended here, and not a realm of theater, but drama of a different sort. This chamber, now re-inhabited, had served other roles in the past. The drafty belfry, thin and constrained, with ceilings pretending to close in on me, was as a child an amphitheater for the hidden arts of our imagination. Me and my brothers, united by boredom, had rejected the outside and rejoiced here, pouring our young energies into games and living daydreams, founding great cities and indeed entire fascinations, weaving fathomless realms where mortals suffered under the intrigues of nefarious spellcasters, role-playing great adventures that had long since faded first to memory and then into nowhere. Dared was I to wonder what had become of the worlds we had bred there. The hex-covered table still stood dutifully. Dice, painted figures, pencils all remained untouched as if waiting patiently for our return, begging for that breath of life that had stirred them once before. The items arranged so casually I scarcely believed I was alone. I dropped the figurine on the floor as a sudden chill pebbled my skin. Intuitively, I looked again at the table, standing like a petrified animal in the half-cloaked darkness. So solemn was the arrangement, it felt irreverent but to touch it. Was I really away for so long? My restless agitation was beginning to play tricks on me, so I aimed my attention to the bed where I could get some much-needed rest. After a few minutes under dusty blankets, I began to drift in and out of sleep. While awake, I glared up from a deep hole of anguish when asleep, black, unsettling dreams would torment me. The phantoms persisted in my mind and then companioned themselves with other eerie feelings, like being observed by an old acquaintance. Those thought-bred, half-lucid moments became more alarming, as did the terrible cough within my lungs, that no depth of cover, no wool's layers could shut out the frigid bite of January. I do not remember half of the dreams I had that night, but I do recall the first, a darksome delusion that began thus. And then it goes into another section. I don't know if you want me to continue or...
Nope, that's a good place to stop. Yeah, that's enough. That's very good. I like the description of the a mother as mustard gas. That was very...
I got that too.
Yeah, that was very good. I like that a lot. Nancy, do you have a reading for us?
I do. I'm actually going to read the very beginning of the book so that I don't have to explain anything.
Okay.
Let's see. Let me start. I will say that this is chapter one. It's called The Journey, and it takes place in Saint-Gérard, which is in the eastern townships of Canada outside of Quebec. It's 1954. The melody had come to him in a dream. It was a haunting sound, refined and vaguely familiar, and it came through the absolute silence of an old-growth cedar forest, not yet ravaged by the steel saws. Something in this music drew him out of his body and invited him to a sacred dance, the vision of the forest still vivid in his floating body. Although he was wandering in search of something he did not know, he felt a new sense of peace and purpose, not unlike a thirsty land quenched at last by a replenishing rain. At the first light, with the dream more real than any event in his recent memory, Bernard closed the doors of his cabin and set out in the direction of the dawn. The music had come to the young man in his sleep, breaking the silence of his waking hours, which had been silenced since he was 5 years old. But now, following the surge of the music in his inner ear, he walked purposely beyond the lake and surrounding autumn landscape of foam, like a scout embarking on his first tribal hunt. His feet paced out the rhythm of the music for 11 hours, yet he felt no tiredness, his sense of purpose still strong. He reached Le Peregrine Creek, taking the old logger's road to where it met the Salmon River at the base of Mount Majantic, following its meandering and keeping just within sight of the undulating terrain of clear cutting. The area around Salpêtrière was first settled by French fur traders in the early 17th century near the junction of the creek and the river, and much later became a lumber town. By the time he found his way to the settlement, however, it had become a ghost town, abandoned for more than three decades. A scandal involving a priest, it was rumored, had sent the town into a downward spiral that decimated the once thriving timber camp. Whole families retreated from Salpêtrière to other nearby towns. A few settled new camps downriver, and others packed up to move southward to New England or back to Europe, until the sawmill eventually shut down for lack of willing workers. Although he had set out at the first dim rays of dawn on foot, assisted by the occasional motor car, he did not reach this main bend of the river until nearly nightfall, much later than he had hoped. The low-grade light of the sun behind the tree line now presented him with a dilemma. Finding it much too dark to proceed into the thicket, but too early to abandon his plan, he parted the low branches of the thick undergrowth on the periphery of the forest, brought himself up as tall as a warrior, and searched the dense woodland floor with his eagle eyes for a trail, a path, or a clearing of some kind to suggest an entrance, a safe passage through the cauldron of this dark evergreen sea. Meanwhile, the sunset had just begun to turn deep dusky red, gold, and navy against the black silhouette of the encircling trees. Directly above, a white crescent moon made her half-sliver appearance, followed by the North Star, a frozen spark above the horizon's diminishing bonfire. He considered whether to enter the dense forest, which would inevitably obliterate the illumination of moonlight. With a sense of purpose still strong, he was keen to advance into the belly of the beast and discover the source of the pull, which, like a fish hook, had lodged itself in a central space in his inner ear and was now working its magic to reel him in. He was a salmon swimming instinctively upriver through a path of undeniable dangers, a night forest replete with predators. But he confronted his momentary fears with uncharacteristic disregard, for tonight, logic and self-preservation were not his masters. His initiation into the forest was a baptism of darkness. Almost immediately, the dim moonlight disappeared, a lamp blown out by a phantom wind, and the darkness descended upon him, swallowed him in its jaws whole. Even the constant strains of music in his head ceased. He turned his whole body to see from where he had arrived, though he was only standing nearly 5 steps from the entrance. He could not determine it, so complete was the blackness. For a moment he felt embalmed by it. Never before had such isolation permeated his being. Without any internal sound or external light, Bernard was a tree in the darkness himself, suspended in time, space, and all existence. And disconnected as he was from his senses and even his earthly body, he soared, first like the night owl low through the trees and then higher and higher until he burst through the treetops and at last found the moonlight that illuminated the view. From this vantage point, he could see a single massive cedar standing tall in the very heart of the forest before a clearing that suggested the widest part of a creek bed or river. The tree stood regal and imposing, a beloved queen presiding over her subjects, a fearless but compassionate leader. Her benevolence and majesty, her very existence, was overwhelming. Then suddenly and without warning, the tree swayed and toppled to the forest floor unceremoniously and seemingly in suspended motion. At that instant, as if the core of his being were transformed into a piece of lead or iron ore, Bernard felt himself sucked back down into the forest floor just as the awful trembling began to subside. When his eyes opened, he was supine on the floor, but in a moment he was standing, now sensing the tremor through his feet and the shock waves filtering through the branches and through his hair. Then, as if on cue, the music slowly began again, first imperceptibly, then rising to a crescendo in his inner ear. Shall I go on?
Oh, that's a good place to stop.
Okay.
Yeah. Like the description of the forest is very evocative. You can feel yourself there. I like that.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can't hear.
Well, we're almost out of time, so I want to ask both of you, what's happening in the future? What's in the works? What do you got going on soon?
Me or her?
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Clyde.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, of course, you know, we keep ourselves busy with the shows. You know, we're doing a lot of we're doing a brand new show coming up this spring called Harken, which is actually like a fantasy themed show. But as far as the book, yeah, I'm hoping to have it done by the end of spring, and then I'd like to try to do self-publish and get that out there. I'm not terribly concerned about making a profit with it. I'm mostly just, would like to get it out there. I think it's going to be something very interesting. So I'm kind of excited about seeing how it does, how it just kind of, how it grows from there.
Great. And Nancy, what's in the works for you?
Yeah, Clive, try Inkwater Press. That's the publisher that I work with. They kind of have a hybrid self-publish, and, you know, they have a publishing company called First Books, which does educational books, but they've created Inkwater as kind of, you know, adult fiction and whatnot. My book was published, last year through Inkwater, and, you know, it's available on Amazon.com. The e-book as well, Kindle version, is available on Amazon and also through Powell's Books. And inkwaterbooks.com. But Amazon is obviously the easiest one. It's also available on my website, which is nmcyoung.com. I'm working on a second book, actually a sequel to Strum. The working title is called Chant.
No.
Canto, I'm trying to decide. And I'm hoping to have that available at the end of 2015 as well. And I would really like to have this be a three-part series, kind of based on the awards. You know, again, when I published it, I didn't think I'd have any audience at all, and I really didn't do it for the money. But it's interesting. Once you do publish, you just want as many people to read it as possible. You know, it's not about the money. It's not about the fame or anything. It's just you just want people to read it. You put in so much into it and so much time and effort and energy, and it has such a great story. I just want people to hear and read it and to appreciate humanity for all the various, you know, manifestations. I'm working on an Audible version as well, and I'm hoping that might be finished hopefully sooner rather than later. I'm actually doing a GoFundMe campaign to try and raise funds to do that. Audible versions are cheaper, expensive as you want to spend, and the more you can spend on it, the better voice actors you can get. So if you're interested, you can go to GoFundMe. The campaign is for, I think it's under NMC Young again, or Strum. I can't remember which, but if you hear anything that you liked and you want to hear it in the Audible version with music, I want to compose and commission some music to go with it. So thank you so much for having me or us, Evan. We really enjoyed this.
Yes, thank you, Clyde, and thank you.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure
For being on the show. And I could have listened to you guys talk metaphysics for longer, but that's just
invite us again.
Maybe I'll have to invite you again and let you go on for even longer about that. Again, thanks again for being on the show. There's more information on my blog about both these writers, and that blog again is blog.s7townsend.com. Or you can get to it through my website at s7townsend.com, or you can Google s7townsend.com, and my website should be the first thing that comes up. Again, thank you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you, Matt.
This has been the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Rightstream Radio.